With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern and I am joined by two people who have also read their fair share of Mark Twain, Heidi White and Tim McIntosh. How's it going, y'all?
Hey, David.
Hey, David. Hey, David, ask Heidi how she's feeling.
Okay, hold on a second. Hey, Heidi, how are you feeling?
Oh, thanks for asking, guys. I have been really sick with the flu. I know, it's a surprise.
I've been sick, but...
It's the worst. It's like a horrible, horrible disease. And I really was like ready for leeches and, oh man, like sent away for a rest cure.
So you know how
bloodletting.
Yeah.
You know how people question the veracity, the success rate of bloodletting and leeches? Mm-hmm. I have been thinking about this and I have a question.
That's because you recently had the flu. That's why you've been thinking about it.
Perhaps they can't prove. I mean, perhaps they. I can see why they don't think that it worked great. But can they prove that it didn't work great? Like, can you prove that leeches didn't work? We may not be able to prove that they do work, but I want to know the science on proving that they didn't work.
It's so true. I mean, I have no. You can't. You can't prove like, a negative, right?
Modern people are so skeptical of things like this. But I want to know, what if we're letting all kinds of health benefits go by not taking leeches on our bodies?
I was ready to try it.
Well, you're back to the land of the living.
So here I am. Sorry about the scratchy voice.
Well, it's that time of year. Tim, I guess that means you're next.
I have been so pleased, not to rub it in or anything, that I haven't gotten sick this year. And it's because I have been taking, like, about every other day, a dose of vitamin C. And I think that just
You've been leeching, haven't you?
I've been heavily leeching. They can't prove that it doesn't work.
It's so true. I mean, you are proving that it does work.
Mm-hmm. My leeching is, yep. Well,
You are a model. You're a data point. Mm. Well, we are here not to discuss leeching or the flu. Although, you know, one never knows what's going to come up and be related to the topic at hand. But we are here to discuss Peace Like a River, Leif Anger's novel, Peace Like a River. We are deep into the heart of the book. We are drawing near to the denouement. And we are going to be discussing one of my favorite sections in this whole book. Just want to throw that out there. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you how you can get in touch with the show. You can, of course, join the conversation along with thousands of other people on the Facebook group. You can go to Close Reads, but you can also go to Instagram or Twitter and follow us along at Close Reads Pods. And then, of course, we do have the email newsletter, which is closereads.substack.com. And then finally, if you want to actually email us directly, you can email us at closereadspodcast@gmail.com. That's a lot of things that you have to keep track of, but you know, maybe one of those things will work out for you. I also want to mention something that we have not yet talked about on the podcast, and that is the Close Reads retreat that's going to be happening this summer. The three of us are going to be hosting, co-hosting. What do you call it when you've got three people hosting something?
Tri-hosting. Yeah.
Well, either way, we're going to be collective.
I think everybody knows that, David. It's tri-hosting.
Like the trifecta. Tri-hosting.
Uh-huh.
We are going to... Trifecta host. A retreat. And we are going to be discussing three of Wendell Berry's short novels, two of his famous essays, and then several of his poems. It's going to be a great retreat. If you ever have been to or heard about the Searcy Summer Institute, it's kind of going to be the same vibe. We're going to be staying at the Shatola Resort in Blowing Rock, North Carolina, up in the mountains. Well, although if you live in Denver, maybe not the mountains for you. Different sort of mountains. But we are going to be...
The Rolling Hills.
The Rolling Hills, North Carolina. Yeah, not quite the Smokies. But we are going to be discussing just the canon of Wendell Berry, what he has to offer for modern people living in a modern world who also perhaps don't want to let go of things that are not so modern. So we're going to eat together. We're going to talk about books together. Each morning we're going to begin with breakfast together and then talk about one of Wendell Berry's poems, the daily poem, if you will, and do that over coffee. And we're going to have great conversations. And it's limited to 15 or so people. So if you want to claim one of the few spots that are available, then get in touch with me. And if you want to learn more, you can head over to CerseiInstitute.com/closereadsretreat to get more information on that. So we've heard a lot from a lot of people over the years who have said that they are interested in some sort of a retreat like that. And this is going to be our first foray into that, I suppose. And we'll see how it goes. And if there's other things like this to be done, but you know, we'd love to have you join us. It's going to be fun. You want to add anything, either of you?
It really is so fun. And I want to cook something this year.
What are you going to cook, Heidi?
I have a plan.
You have the flu though, so you might get people
sick.
Well,
not today. I can't get you sick over the airway. Maybe I can. That would be power.
That would be power.
So, can't prove that you can't.
Can't prove that you can't. But yes, we should maybe try some leeching.
I don't think anyone wants to eat leeches. Tim, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, I have a question. What are people going to feel like at the end of this retreat? You know what I mean? Like, I have a notion
victorious.
Of what it's going to be like. They're going to feel victorious.
Yeah, they're going to retreat and they're going to retreat and they're going to retreat until they're victorious.
Very British.
Do the British retreat?
They celebrate their retreats, right? Isn't that into the Valley of Death rode the 600?
Yes. I'm with you now. Tim, what are you hoping to feel like at the end of the retreat? Because most likely we're all going to feel exhausted but happy.
That's exactly what I'm hoping for. That's what I feel like at the end of a Circe conference. I'm like slap exhausted and very content, and I'm kind of hoping the same thing will happen.
Yes. So here's the way I think about it. I think this is a good metaphor, and also it's not a metaphor because I think it's going to be true. You know how you go to a great restaurant? Like one year we were in Charleston and we all went to this oyster joint, right? Oh, and we had a tower of oysters and all kinds of other seafood, and we had wine and we were there for a long time. And so you go and you do that and you have multiple courses and it's a whole experience, right? And it takes you, if you're doing it right, it takes you a long time. By the end of that, you're full. You don't feel like you want to walk anywhere in 100 degree weather back to a hotel, say. And yet you feel happy. That is what I think it's going to be like. I can't promise there's going to be oysters there. In fact, I would say there probably won't be. But otherwise, you know, I think it works out as a metaphor.
I love it.
Yep.
I agree.
Well, speaking of being full and being happy, let's talk about Peace Like a River. I mentioned my little quip at the beginning about how you both are people who have read your fair share of Mark Twain, which is a line, of course, from this section where he, I believe it's in maybe even the first chapter in this section, he says, of course, I'd read as much Twain as the next boy. And it's where Davy is saying, you think you can get out of the house without rousting anybody? Mm-hmm. Well, of course I could, he says. I'd read as much Twain as the next boy. So this is the section where Davy comes back into our lives, into their lives. And I was wondering, did you feel any kind of like, were there any, we obviously have the sort of like structural shift in terms of the characters are brought back in and the sort of journey to a place has clearly kind of come to an end for now. Now the journey might pick up again, but they're at worst case at a sort of like Rivendell situation here, right? If they haven't found a new home. Mm-hmm. Did you feel any tonal shifts to go along with the sort of thematic shift that we get in this section now that Davy comes back? I wanted to kind of start there as we dive into the section. Tim, what do you think about that? Did you recognize anything like that?
It felt like the I don't know how to say this. It became a little bit of a drama again. It's been a drama the whole time, but it felt like the traction of, especially by the end of the section, the traction of finding Davy and saving Davy now is of utmost importance. And it's always been very important, but the pace of the last two sections has been rather leisurely. And now we have no time to waste. So I don't know if it's I guess with that comes a tonal shift, but for me, it's more like the plot has now we've turned a little bit away from the budding romance between Mr. Land and Roxanne. We've turned away from this question of the Federale, kind of like, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Now it's just, we've got to find Davy, and there's this really sketchy character that we were introduced to in this section. Is he as dangerous a guy as Reuben thinks he might be? And what's going to happen to his kind of like live-in daughter who he's grooming to be his wife? Like, all that stuff is now...
You just said something out loud that is a very weird thing to have to say out loud.
Yeah, I know.
Daughter who he's grooming to be his wife.
Right.
That's it.
But, it's part of like what makes this thing... It's now turned into, I don't know if the cliffhanger is the right word, but it's turned into a drama where we've got to kind of like, some rescuing needs to take place.
Yeah, the sort of force of the plot is starting to generate some energy
in
throughout the pages. I like that you pointed out that we've kind of gotten past, or at least by the end of this section, we have gotten past the notion of Andresen being a putrid fed, you know, like being a bad guy. He gets more and more humanized as the section goes on, and you know, partly because the father begins to sympathize, or at least empathize with him and see the good in him. And by the end of the section, you know, Reuben is debating within himself to what degree like whether he's an enemy. You know, he keeps calling himself the enemy, and then by the end of it, he has recognized that maybe the Fed isn't the enemy anymore, and a sort of new enemy has emerged onto the scene, which is interesting because you don't often have that kind of a shift with 50 pages left in a book, or right towards the final chapters, where the guy you thought maybe was the bad guy all along is all of a sudden maybe on your side, and maybe you're after the same things, but there's a new guy who you have to sort of decide if he's a bad guy.
You know, okay, I had a question about this
thing to do.
Do you think that the change regarding Andresen is a change just within kind of like the heart of Davy, or is it, or did something happen? I'm not asking that question very well. Clearly, I think that Andresen is not, like, nothing is like really changed profoundly in his character. He's been doing the same thing that he's been doing the whole time. And so it's just a change within Davy's kind of perception of him. So is it that Davy now kind of believes what his dad has told him about, that Andresen is not a bad guy?
You mean Reuben?
I'm sorry, Reuben. I'm so sorry. Has Reuben's heart changed regarding Mr. Andresen, or is it that like there's a new bad guy? The new bad guy is this Walzer character, and there's kind of only room enough for one bad guy. And Andresen, you know, Reuben doesn't think all of a sudden he's a good guy, but he's just not the primary threat.
Heidi, do we have any sense of the actual character of Andresen, however you want to say it? Is he, and I don't mean like, do we have a sense of him as a character in terms of like the literary term, but actually in terms of the character of the person himself, like, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? They thought that maybe he was a threat, Swede, and well, the whole family did, I suppose. But now they don't think about him that way. So what do we actually know about this guy?
Right. Well, Leif Enger is so good at drawing characters that any kind of fuzziness or missingness, so to speak, in a character is intentional on his part. And so Andresen, to me, seems intentionally left a bit fuzzy. Like, you don't have the same details about him that draw these incredible sketches of character in just a page or two, like you'd get with, say, August or the earlier lawyer who helped them out, whose name I can't recall right now. I think that's intentional on Leifinger's part, and I think it serves a really good purpose, because what we've discovered in the reading that we did this week is that the threat, you use the word threat, and I think that's the right word. The threat up to the reading this week was that Davy would get caught and go to jail and would be lost to them forever. Mm-hmm. The threat has now shifted. That's no longer that's a very minor threat compared to the one that we have now, with like a real devil character who's obviously not just, you know, representative of justice per se, the way Anderson is, but is actually malevolent.
Yeah.
So that then makes Anderson no longer a threat, and probably is in some ways threatened himself. And so that he's now another person looking for Davy, that if he finds Davy, he's in danger. So that everything has changed with this reading. Everything has changed. And it was, I think, just an absolutely brilliant twist. It's a Western, it's fairy tale, it's biblical narrative. I mean, it's everything. Like I was on the edge of my seat.
Hey, were you guys surprised by the twist, or did you see it coming? That Reuben kind of perceived that Walter wasn't worried about finding Andreessen because Walter planned to kill him. Were you surprised to learn that, or did you kind of see it?
Well, David's read it before. Do you remember the first time that you read it, David? Were you surprised?
I don't remember, but yeah. The funny thing is I didn't remember, and it's been a couple of years. I didn't remember the exact sort of mechanism by which it was all, by which that sort of twist was revealed.
Right.
In terms of the twist that Anderson, the guy that Walter is going to go after Anderson. I went back and reread the section a couple of times, cause I was trying to figure out what's the clue that became obvious to Reuben what was going on. And there's the line on 273 where it says, well, his dad says, "Rube, that Anderson's a smart fellow, but he doesn't know one thing about winter in North Dakota." Mm-hmm. And then the next line is, "A thought dropped from nowhere like a big snake." And then that's the moment when he, that's the moment when he realizes what's happening.
Right.
There is a sort of, lack of, it's got kind of a deus ex machina thing going on there.
Yeah.
Wait, what? He just realized this? How did he realize it? And the book doesn't go to great pains, at least to this point, to tell us why he realized that. And part of me, I wonder if it there's something, about it that's like his dad, maybe the deus ex machina part is sort of the point.
Right.
Well, but Tim, you asked about being surprised. Does that mean that you were surprised that that Reuben realized it?
That Reuben saw it. Yeah, I was surprised. Pleasantly surprised. I thought it was a great twist.
And do you mean surprised? Like you were surprised that Walter was going to do that, or that Reuben recognized it?
Both, I think. I think I was a little bit more surprised that Walter was going to do it, not because Walter, it's beyond him. Like he is the sort of character that would never do that sort of thing. It's sort of like his malevolence was irritating and I don't know how to describe it. It was not as aggressive. It was sort of like a passive malevolence before that point. And then it became really active. If that makes any sort of sense, please don't hear me say hey, he was just kind of like an innocent kind of guy. No, not at all.
Yeah.
But there was something
sinister, but not malevolent.
Yeah. Maybe something like that. I mean, the whole thing with the girl is like deep down malevolent. Yeah,
he's seemed evil to me from the minute that Reuben walked in that cabin, the grooming of a child bride is just preparation for lifelong sex slavery. Like that's not maybe this is a bad guy. Like that's just plain evil. Like he's evil personified. And
but don't we get that Heidi a little bit later? Like after we've kind of known him for a little while.
Yeah, maybe.
And I'm
but there's sulfur going in front of the cabin, and even the way that Davy, you're right. It unfolds. It does unfold, but the full depth of it is, I think, pretty quickly seen.
Yeah. 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 Well, actually one thing I really like about what he does here with this and this sort of sinister nature of both Jape and the place that he lives is that it seems like Roxanna's home then is sort of surrounded by yes. all of these sort of like hellish places. So whether it's the sulfurous broken down place where Jape lives, or it's the fiery place that they had gone, you know, previously, or it's just all the snow, the sort of wasteland, it makes her place that much more of a, I mentioned Rivendell earlier, but that much more of a sort of Rivendell place. And it makes her that much more of a sort of, I know we mentioned Beatrice last time, and mm-hmm. that's maybe a bit of a stretch, but it makes her that sort of character. You know, she's surrounded by all this sinister wilderness, but her place is a sort of light in the middle of that.
Yeah, that's really well said, David. I think that's true.
I was thinking about how this chapter is a sort of collision of, we've had these collisions, this section, not this chapter, because we read multiple chapters. We've had a lot of different like problems the characters have had to solve, you know, and there's decisions they've had to make. And there's been sort of ostensible bad guys, whether it's the two boys at the beginning, or then Anderson, or the snow, or whatever it is, the journey itself. But here, it does seem like we're getting these collisions of like these, almost like collisions of worldviews, you know? And I was wondering if that's where the sort of sinister nature of things, like the book feels more dangerous because of that. Does that make sense?
David, can you say more about the clash of worldviews that you're seeing?
Yeah. Okay. So like in the past, Anderson's sort of like a duty-bound guy who is just, he has just, his duty tells him he has to do something that is harmful to someone that they love. So that's not really evil, right? Like the problem they have to solve is that they have to figure out, what do you do when someone you love does something they shouldn't do and people who are in charge are after them? Like, that's a complicated moral problem, but they were never like, they're never really in danger per se, you know, like nothing's really going to happen to Reuben probably. Right.
Mm. Aside from his asthma probably. Yeah.
Right. And that, I actually think that's one of the reasons why the asthma has to be there, because it adds a layer of difficulty, a layer of danger.
It's an obstacle. Yeah. Right.
I agree.
You know, it kind of heightens the tension and the drama of the first half of the book, especially, right. But also there's a lot of things we can talk about that. But then here, when we get into Walter, his sinisterness is sinister in a way that's different from Anderson, as we've been saying. He's actually evil. And there's this part, it's on 233.
Okay.
They're about to eat, and he says, let's see. Well, at the bottom of 232, I lowered my head in panic. Not for a moment had I believed my narrative would be required. So they've just explained to Dave, to Reuben, how they met, how Davy met Walter. And also the lateness of the hour suddenly landed on my shoulders. It had to be 2 a.m. I guess I shut my eyes a moment. Reuben, what are you doing? I looked at him through twisting steam from the Dutch oven. He'd frozen as if detecting betrayal. Nothing, I said. Are you praying over this meal I've provided? No, Mr. Walter. I'd forgotten to pray, though you may believe I felt like doing so now. You are thanking God for the food, he said, when he did not give it to you. I gave it to you and did so freely. Thank me. I nodded. Call me Craven. You weren't there. Thank me then. I looked at Davy, who was watching his plate. I said, thank you, Mr. Walter. It looks like a good meal. He goes on a little bit. And then there's the funny line where he says, I never had a predisposition towards pants wetting, but suddenly it seemed quite possible. So even in like this really sinister moment, Leifanger drops in a little bit of humor, which I think is really, a psychologist could have fun with how people deal with trauma in the moment, right? Or at least in their memory. And then at the end, they talk about the notion of being led. And he says, I saw he suspected Davy that he might have given them away. I said, we didn't even mean to stop here. Our car broke down and we got snowed in. So no one led you here, he said. Well, the question was dismaying. Of course we'd been led. Why did everyone keep bringing this up? We'd been led by the bushel. And I was thinking about how, even just on this one page, at the top of the page, Walter says, God did not give you this food. I gave it to you. Thank me. And then at the bottom, there's this question of like the idea of being led. And Davy and Reuben, saying, of course we'd been led And so in this moment, there's like these collisions of whatever Walter's world sort of worldview is, which is sort of in some ways representative of a more sinister, more sick version of like I'm my own man, sort of American independence, like the sort of make your own way type perspective. It's like a sick version of that. And then on the other hand, there's the version that's sort of the worldview that's sort of represented by Davy's father, and it's a worldview of faith, right? And being sensitive to those sorts of things, whereas Walter's closing himself off. So in this moment, we have this collision of those two things, and I think that that makes that brings to light the evilness. And then the thing is that makes it, that adds a little bit of pathos to it, is that Davy's it brought into the scene.
Right,
he's caught in the middle, and he won't look at either of them. I think that's really important.
Yes.
I love that little image that Davy's just looking at his plate. He refuses to look at Reuben for support, to support him. And he also won't look at Walter. All he can do is be stuck between them and look at his plate. And so in the middle of this collision is this character who Reuben loves, who we all kind of like hope the best for. And that to me is like the moment where the rest of the story seems to be setting on the path towards its denouement, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I totally see what you're saying, and the way that Walter approaches Reuben's asthma, I think, is also kind of indicative of how he views the world. Mr. Land, by contrast, views Reuben's asthma. There's a sort of appropriate fear and concern and humility. That's the better word. About what's going on with Reuben, and Mr. Land asks Reuben like what the treatment ought to be in some ways. You know, like even the doctor that kind of, I don't know, the doctor was a quack that came in, but you know, he has these really strong opinions about the vinegar and the water, you know, that this doesn't work. But Mr. Land kind of goes back to Davy to verify if he thinks that it would work. So sorry, why do I keep saying Davy? Goes back to Reuben.
I did have done it too.
And asks Reuben if he thinks that it works. And kind of like repeatedly, Mr. Land, the treatment of the asthma is done with great humility, and he wants to know what Reuben thinks is working. Whereas Walzer's approach, I mean, there was a while there, I was like, man, Reuben is going, his lungs are filling up, and Walter's going to teach him how to breathe. That was the thing that, like, oh my gosh, that made me so mad. Made me so mad on top of all the other things that I knew about Walter. So that sort of the lack of humility with regards to Reuben's illness is really telling. It says a lot about Walter.
Right. Well, and I'm seeing something else in the story, which is like Walter's a true psychopath. Like he's written perfectly, like perfectly for the personality disorder of psychopathy, which hunts down young, vulnerable victims to be groomed and brought into the lifestyle, right? So what we have then is before Anderson, who represents the law, like the biggest danger to Davy was the law. And now even Davy, who's this independent, you know, American hero, he did something in the name of justice and we all have an opinion about it, but he goes off into the sunset and finds his way, right? Like in some ways he's a heroic figure until we see him in this portion, in which case he's just as trapped as everybody else in the story.
Yeah.
And is trapped because of his own choices. And now his brother, Reuben, puts him in an impossible situation, either turn himself into the father who he suspects is going to turn, who he knows now is in cahoots with Anderson driving around. Davy knows that. And go to jail, or else put Reuben in the position of bringing him to this psychopath and making him another victim, or going to jail. Like, so everybody in this section is caught in these competing forces of loyalty, competing vows, impossible choices. How do you find your way in the midst of this tangle that's coming? And you use the word David, I think it was you used the word denouement, of course, means untangling. So I know we're getting there, but life is, anger is, I mean, we are all tangled up in this section and nobody knows what to do, including Davey, who's always been independent. In the face of such bald evil as Jabe Walzer is, everybody is trapped.
You know, one thing I like this, the idea of the tangling, untangling, because I think it's really interesting the way anger is doing this, because he's creating, he both is tangling everyone up in terms of the choices they have to make, but he's doing that while also being very clear about who is honorable and who is not, and who is like dishonorable, I guess, or who is evil.
Right.
I think that's one of the reasons why there's the scene where they're trying to talk about where Sweet and Ruben are talking about why their dad is sort of a different person all of a sudden. And then he goes to live in the Airstream and Sweet says, it's all about honor. And, and Ruben says, you know, I was envious of her recognizing that. Cause the excuse that he was just testing all the heaters would have worked on me, he says. And so on the one hand, the choices they have to make become more complicated the more black and white the lines are between the antagonist and the protagonist, or the groups of people that are the antagonist and the protagonist. I mean, even like the way he writes, like there's in the moment when he meets Walzer and he passes out, because Walzer's like forcing him to just overcome his breathing problem, you know? Mm-hmm. I like that you said he's trying to groom, like a psychopath grooms young people, because it is like he's trying to groom him into taking power and control. And there's a sort of like Dark Lord Sith vibe going on there. Like, use the force, overcome your breathing, right? Overcome this breathing problem. You can do it. And then when he does, he passes out. And when he passes out, he has this dream. The dream that you mentioned earlier, or last week at least, comes back to him. Mm-hmm. And it's not a coincidence. Like, the book presenting this dream in connection with Walzer is a very black and white choice by Enger.
Yep.
So we're getting all these symbols and moments that make the lines ever more stark while also making their choices that much more complicated. And so I think that's one of the great things that Enger manages to do in this book, and why I think we get so, I think that's part of why, Tim, the drama gets ramped up a lot.
Yeah.
It feels like it's got, like it's just it's becoming much more aggressive. Like, you have to keep turning the pages. You know, it's a lot less pastoral.
The stakes are getting higher. Stakes are getting way higher. This is no longer a family drama about what if Davey goes to jail. Like, this is, like, did he do the right thing in killing those boys? Like, that's, it's almost, we've moved beyond that. Like, that's, those are really good questions and complicated questions. But now we're talking about Walzer owning this entire family and Ruben's health. I mean, he's clearly dying. So this, like, the stakes are getting really, really high.
And now Ruben is about to go out on this kind of like hunt when his lungs have been really in a dangerous spot. So this adds like a whole other complication to what we're about to read in the last section.
Right.
I'm a little bit nervous about the last section.
Yeah. It's not just a question of, is there going to be a gunfight and someone's going to get caught in the crossfire or something? It's like, this person probably isn't capable of doing what he needs to do
now. Yeah, right, right.
It's not just that there's danger. It's that it's about capacity.
Right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Is Davey tells Ruben that he's not scared of Walzer, right? I think kind of like earlier in this section, he says something, you know, he's like, he's not worried about him. Is that, do you believe Davey?
Oh, such a good question. I wrote that in the margin. I put little question marks by that. Because now I think Davey's in danger. The state of Davey's state is so precarious here. And before, it's been that he's kind of outside the boundaries of the law and he's, you know, an outlaw, like a Western outlaw. You know, he's going to ride into town and shoot up the bad guys and take the girl and be the new sheriff in town. Like, he's, but now he is in very grave danger, and it's almost more dangerous if he's not afraid of Walzer.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think it is more, it is more dangerous if he's not afraid of Walzer. There's only a couple of reasons why he wouldn't be. One, he's he's falling under his spell.
Yeah.
Or two, he's foolhardy and doesn't see how dangerous he is. Yeah. Or three, has some kind of master plan, and maybe that's it. But the point is, he should be afraid of him. The only right response to that kind of evil is fear and running in the opposite direction. And Davy is being sheltered by it. And so now I think, and then you look at, you know, the counterpoint to Davy is not Reuben and it's not Jape. It's his father. It's Jeremiah Land. He's the one on the other side. He's the one balancing and harmonizing Davy. And he's on the opposite pole. And he's the one joining Anderson and going to look for him. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is like, it's better for Davy to be in jail than to be with this, whoever he's with.
Mm. Yeah. Huh. I think that there is the moment that I said earlier where he won't look at either of them. Uh-huh. I think there is in that at least some vestiges of, I guess, fear maybe is the word. Like, you know that he maybe says he's not afraid, and maybe fear is the wrong word. Maybe he wouldn't call it fear, but I don't think he, you know, I think he also recognizes Walter for what he is. But maybe he doesn't realize the degree. Maybe he is to some degree falling under his spell. And so when he won't look at him, it's like he still has a little bit of resistance in him.
Right. Well, and he can't leave because of Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And also, where's he going to go?
Right.
Yeah, where's he going to go? I kind of read it as Davy's kind of the opinion that he's got this under control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean,
or at least he's telling himself that.
Right.
Or at least, I think he really, really wants to believe that. Like, hey, you know, I killed two men. That's the kind of, you know, I'm capable of that sort of reckoning. Right. And this Walter is just kind of a kook that lives out, you know, in the middle of the Badlands. I got this under control. And I think he definitely wants to believe that.
Right. Well, the way we all do, right? When we have some kind of great temptation and we think we can handle it.
Uh-huh.
I'll just, you know, dabble in this for a little while. It's protecting me, right? Like there's, So it is self-deception.
Like Frodo with the ring.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yep. Well, and that's why the story is so great, is because it doesn't let Davy be a romantic hero. And I really just love that.
Yeah. There's all these references in this section to Butch Cassidy.
Uh-huh.
And I love that because it keeps coming back to the idea of legends and myth and the gray area in legends and myths. And in some way, the story reads like, I was thinking a lot about how it reads like it's being told orally, not written down. Whereas Sweet is this great writer. The book has all these marks, these like markers in it of a story that could be told orally. And that I think plays into this kind of, like this book itself could be sort of a legend that's passed down. There's all these things that are barely believable that you would get in stories where barely believable things are constantly happening, especially in all kinds of like Americana. I don't remember what I was.
I think also the Butch Cassidy story about what happens, isn't the story that we get about Butch Cassidy kind of what happens to him after he retires from his
outlawry,
right? And he kind of becomes a redeemed citizen in some way, becomes this church going man. And I'm wondering if we are being, if this is the story of Davy, not just that Swede wants us, that Swede wants to believe that, but maybe this is kind of what's going to happen with Davy.
A sort of foreshadowing.
Yeah.
I think at least thematically, I think by offering that possibility, it creates more tension, more drama, more possibility, so that if it does or doesn't happen, there's payoff one way or the other.
Right.
So Tim, a little bit ago, you mentioned the idea of, I think it was you, Tim, you mentioned the idea of control, right? That maybe he feels like he has everything under control. Davy does. Was that you?
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of this before you said that, but it seems like a lot of this book is about the concept of control. And maybe on the one hand, every book is about the concept of like that sort of the notion of problem solving or problems or obstacles or whatever is inherently a question of control. Mm. And I've never thought about narratives that way before. That the characters are just trying to make sure that they have or acquire some kind of control over a situation. Or they're trying to respond to the fact that they don't have control over the situation. Maybe that's what it is. But it seems like this book in particular is about the theme of control. So right. Andresen is trying to control the family to help him figure things out. The boys at the beginning are out of control, and David then takes control of the situation. They can't control, you know, people are always trying to control his lungs. There's all these, he's being told by Walter, control your lungs, be a man, right? Essentially, that's what he's saying. And his father's trying to come up with all these remedies that will control the problem, keep it from getting worse. When he gets, when Jeremiah Lane gets pneumonia, they're trying to control the symptoms and keep them from getting worse. And there's all these different questions of how do you wrangle, to use the Western metaphor, a horse that's just so wild that you can't control it, that a corral mm-hmm. doesn't keep it. It seems to be an ongoing theme in this book. Do you buy that?
Can I add one more? I mean, can we say that Sweet is trying to...
Oh, yeah.
She's trying to control the meaning of what's happening with them by sort of shopping different potential narratives to what is going on.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe in some way she's trying to control her own heart by doing that.
Yeah, right. Maybe so.
I think it's brilliant. I think that totally works. Which is why, as you pointed out earlier, David, about the asthma and how important that is. It really wouldn't be the same story without the asthma. And the theory you're proposing right now.
I do like the idea of a propounding, though.
I know. I talk good. That's why
I got a few good words.
That's right. That it covers that, this kind of continual wrestling for control, even of very survival.
Yeah. So then what does that tell us about Jeremiah Land? Because is he sort of, by his faithfulness, releasing control? Is that what makes him different?
Well, while I was laying in bed in a feverish mess the other day, I was thinking about the book and about how air is so important, because Reuben is struggling for air all the time. And he's struggling to control his own survival all the time, and he can't. And other people attempt to do it for him, but they can't. Not even Jeremiah Land can. But Jeremiah Land was freed from his control, in a sense, by being picked up by a gust of air. Right? That was his, when he was picked up by the tornado or whatever, it was a tornado, right? Yeah. And then it's while he's up floating in the air, completely out of control.
This is good, because there's something like this happens in this section.
Then he realizes that he's not in control. And then he lives the rest of his life with this open-handed generosity and mercy towards everything that he encounters.
Yeah.
It's so much so. And I think this is where I struggled so much with Jeremiah Land, and is that he doesn't, because I'm a controlling person, right? So I read this story and I'm like, tell your kids how to live. like, tell them what to do. Like, they are completely out of control and you are not telling them what to do. Mm. And you're living this very virtuous life, Mr. Land, but you're not telling them what to do with their confusing life. And now I'm like, oh, like maybe that's kind of the whole point. Huh.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the tornado as breath, because I hadn't thought of that. But then during this section, right at the very end, we get another sort of breath in the form of a natural occurrence. On 270, it says, no word arrived from Andresen that day or the next. what did arrive was a northwest wind that sang against the house. In the Dakotas, it needn't snow to blizzard. The wind came low and fast, peeling the drifts. And then he talks about it was ground wind, a ground blizzard. Picture a storm to match any in wildness, but only 8 feet high. Which then that has to call back the earlier storm. Any storm, it says, but only 8 feet high, which is like the opposite of the storm that is way up in the sky that lifts the father. And it talks about like how in the middle of the storm, Roxana's red birdhouse was on a stilting pole. And above the storm, it was actually sunny. We could see the gleaming tin dome of a neighbor siloed miles away. And the wind lasted 2 days. And then we get the final part of this chapter where he realizes what's going on with Walzer and Anderson. So maybe these sort of natural breathings, if you will, are, you know, representative of like releasing control or some sort of clarity related to that or something.
Right.
Or maybe that's reading too much into it.
No, I think that that's part of it. Like that the extravagance of breath available to every other character other than Reuben, who's continually being closed in and is by far the most pressured character in the story other than Davy. Like he's the witness. He has all of these, he knows both sides of this story and does not know what to do at this point. It's all closing in on him.
Oh, this is so good. Because at the end of the next page that I read, he then has this conversation. You know, he's all worried about Davy. And so he says to Swede, you know, how long do you think you'd survive in this kind of wind? And and then she tells him all these stories about like the college boys from Wyoming and who took off their clothes because they were actually felt warm and then they froze to death. And so she has all these sort of things that she tells him. And then at the end, it says, sitting by Swede as she read silently on the couch, I counted six of my breaths to each of hers.
Each of hers.
What I wanted was a great big inhale, or failing that, a little peace. I ventured out to the airstream. And so...
The airstream.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow, that is kind of remarkable. It does feel like we kind of stumbled. Maybe, no, I shouldn't say stumbled. David saw something I did not see.
Well, I just think it's funny because on the one hand, it's one of those like using the airstream as this part of the story is like so obvious.
Yeah.
But then it's also such a real thing that you don't, until you realize it, like it doesn't feel obvious, right? I mean, lots of people probably thought, oh, airstream, that's obvious. But then a lot of people probably didn't think about it at all because
I didn't think about it at all.
It's just a thing. Yeah.
It's a real concrete, it's an actual brand.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like he made up a character's name to me, like you know, to be super obvious, but it's obvious at the same time. but the kind of concept of her only, like her breathing six times for his one breath is meaningful, you know. It does sort of speak to like he's constantly feeling behind or trapped, like he doesn't have like what's the things that are possible to other people aren't possible to him.
Right.
Makes it sort of sad.
I also wonder if the this kind of thematic element of the wind or blowing. I mean, the John 3, what does Jesus compare like the spirit to? It's the wind that blows.
Right.
It goes where it wants to. You hear the sound of it, but you don't know where it's going. You don't know where it's coming from. So is everyone who is born of the spirit. And that seems like Mr. Land more than anybody else. He's enigmatic in some way, but I don't think that he's deliberately shrouded by anger. I think he's one who's born of the spirit.
Right. Which is mysterious to
what is
less holy people who still want to take control of everything. Me.
Yeah.
So.
But so, okay, so what does that tell us
then? Yourself, Heidi.
What does it mean, though, metaphorically or otherwise, analogously or otherwise, about the state of Reuben's soul then?
Right.
If he is short of breath and his father is endowed with this breath, but then there's this inability for the father to pass that breath on to his son. Like, is it too much to start asking these sort of questions? Or
no, that's been my question the entire novel, which is how is this child going to be saved? This is not about Davy, it's about Reuben.
How like, is he going to be given the breath?
Yes, like he's, and that, so that, that's where I'm like, oh, I have this theory about the end of the story, but this is a story about Davy, but the central character, the witness character, is a child who can't actually survive in the world. And that, and the pressures on this child are bearing down so much that he no longer can catch his breath. It's an objective correlative to his soul. I really think that's true. And we're coming, I think, to a breaking point for him.
Is it an objective correlative to every soul?
Probably, yes.
Or maybe to the concept of, you know, coming of age. Like if this is, say, a Bildungsroman or however you choose to pronounce a word that no one knows how to pronounce, is it a sort of meta discourse, a meta narrative on the nature of a coming of age story? And then like a coming of age story is learning, is either getting, at the end of a coming of age story or a Bildungsroman, you're either going to have been given the breath to live, or the breath is going to be gone and you're either not going to live or you're going to be living a different way. Like,
right. Well, and it's a perfect metaphor. Like it's perfect. Because he can't catch his breath on his own. And that's what makes Jape Walzer such an evil person. Right. Like while he was talking to him about the stars, like, I was so creeped out. It reminded me so much of That Hideous Strength and like the systematic destruction of Mark Stoddard's humanity throughout that novel by NICE, the organization.
Yeah. You're talking about the C.S. Lewis novel.
Yes. This distortion of or inversion of education. Like you can tell that Jape Walzer is like, I'll take this young boy under my wing and I will teach him my ways. And that is, I mean, that's one possible future for Reuben and for Davy.
Why do you think Davy takes Reuben there in the first place? I was thinking a lot about that because it's sort of off stage. It happens off stage that he decides to do that.
Ostensibly, it's because Reuben threatens to tell Jeremiah Land that he saw Davy. But I don't know if that's compelling enough because Davy could just then disappear and not come back.
All right. That's the thing. Like Davy could just go back to the woods. What do you think, Tim? Why does he choose to bring him there?
My question would be slightly different. Why does he allow himself to be seen by Reuben? Because it seems like once that happens.
Yeah. That's true.
Then it's a distinct possibility that he's going to have to take action with regards to Reuben and explain himself. And maybe it's an accident. You know, maybe he just wanted to see his family and Reuben happened to catch a glimpse of him. But I don't know. I don't know.
Do you think he brings him there because Walzer says you have to bring him here?
Maybe. Because Davy knows that Reuben is... that Reuben is easily influenced. He saw him on the witness stand. So, you know, like if it's an odd decision unless he was told to do it or unless he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Man, that's my estimation of Davy. If he said yes to Walzer, my estimation of Davy drops pretty significantly.
So what do you think? Do you think he wanted to then?
I don't think he wanted to. I think, again, I'm locating the decision for Davy in either choosing to be seen. And I think he kind of got talked into taking Reuben to the place where Davy's been hiding out. And so did Davy intentionally get seen? I kind of think so. And I just think because he wanted to be seen.
Yeah.
Because he misses his brother and he misses his family. And then I think it kind of falls like dominoes after that. I have a hard time believing that Davy would, even if Davy is not aware of this sort of grotesque demonic that's lurking behind or within Walzer. Even if he's ignorant of that, I would think like on some sort of a subconscious level, I don't know, like bringing Davy into that sort of danger and having Davy, bringing Reuben toward that sort of danger seems, I don't think that Davy would do that. I might be wrong, but I don't think that Davy would do that. So that to me either means, I think it means that he doesn't think that Walzer is that big of a threat yet. I think he thinks he's like a pretty bad guy, but I think Davy thinks he's got it under control. That's my read. So he's not afraid to bring Reuben to Walzer because Davy's got it under control.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to ask Mr. Anger that question.
Mm-hmm.
Why
Heidi, do you think that, what do you think?
I mean, if I'm being honest, I don't think there's a strong enough, I don't think the novel gives us a strong enough motive. My particular take is...
Is that a criticism or you think that it's not what the novel is interested
in? No. It's a bit of a criticism. I think this is a weak point in the novel, but there might be something I've missed.
But you think...
So can I take this back to clarify? We're talking about... Are we talking about why he allows himself to be seen, Heidi, or why he brings Davy back to Walzer?
Why he brings Davy back to Walzer. Good question. Okay. Yeah. I don't think the novel gives us a strong enough reason considering Davy's strength of character. So I think Tim's right. It's either that he doesn't know how evil Walzer is, but that doesn't seem... I don't know... Knowing Sarah's presence and that Davy knows what Sarah's there for, that seems really, and that he would bring in his brother there seems.
So Heidi, what if he, again, this is taking like my read on it. What if he thinks I got this under control and I'm going to rescue Sarah? I'm not even worried about my ability to rescue Sarah. I'm going to.
Maybe just pride on Davy's part, overreaching, like a dismissal. But he went to such lengths to protect his family already that it seems uncharacteristic for him to bring Reuben there.
Yeah.
So that to me is like, as I was reading it, I kept thinking, I don't know if Anger's given us a strong enough motivation on Davy's side, knowing what we know about Davy's strength of character. But like I said, I might've missed something, or there might be something that, you know, that I'm not seeing about Davy.
Well, let me ask you this. You say knowing Davy's strength of character. So then, you know, the question, the follow-up is, what do we know about Davy's strength of character?
I think that his protection of his family, that he's gone to such great lengths to do that, his independence, and he's not easily manipulated, and he does know that Reuben is easily influenced.
So, well, maybe one of the things to consider then is that I've never thought about this before, but what if the novel is sort of telling us that the way we feel about Davy is similar to the way Reuben feels about Davy, and maybe neither of us should have felt the way we do.
Right.
Maybe he didn't shoot the two boys to protect his family. Maybe he shot them because he was angry. Like it was much, maybe it wasn't about justice and it was more about hate, or like a drifting towards hate.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And maybe he's under Walzer's influence more than we know. And then Reuben's presence there, being in danger, maybe he kind of brings him here to show him off. Look what I found. And then Jape Walzer's cruelty and manipulation of Reuben changes Davy's mind.
One thing I was wondering is, let's assume that Davy's not kind of bad guy. We'll just put it that way. I know it's overly simplistic, but let's put it that way.
Yeah, I don't think he's a bad guy.
I don't mean like a bad guy, like in the technical term.
Right, I know.
But I just mean like maybe he's not. I don't know. I think that he's, I don't think he's as noble as the first part of the book wants you to think, because I think that the first part of the book is from Reuben's perspective, and Reuben's perspective is
looking up to his older brother.
Yeah, it's sort of changing. So we, by the end of this section, there's this question of Anderson is that Walter's going to kill Anderson, that he's luring him sort of into a trap. And that's what Reuben realizes. What if what Davey's trying to do is show that Reuben and the family is not a threat. And so then Walter doesn't need to kill them or go after them to preserve his own independence. Like, what if he's trying to say, I mean, on the one hand, it's like inviting him, the boy, into the belly of the beast, but also maybe he believes in Reuben enough, unlike everybody else, except Jeremiah, that he can prove that they're not actually a threat to Walter.
Well, I think that Reuben's malleability, if that's a word, lends itself to that theory for sure. Like, certainly. But the risk then is just the practical one of Reuben's malleability combined with the fact that now Reuben knows the way, the actual geography of the cabin. So that actually puts them in more of danger, right?
So that maybe he's using, yeah, I mean, you said it's a, man, the more I think about it, I actually think that the questions of his motivation, especially at this point in the novel, like as you're reading it, being, not being sure why he does what he does, I actually think it might be a strength in complicating the novel. Yeah. Like, I don't, Tim, do you think it's a flaw that if we don't know why the motive, like why Davey's motivations are what they are, do you feel like that's a flaw, like Heidi was suggesting?
I tend to, and maybe we'll get to the end and we'll know it, in which case, you know, it would be not a flaw, but, you know, like,
we can all look back on this conversation, have a good laugh.
Right. But yeah, I do think it's a very significant decision to bring, to bring Reuben kind of into the clutches of Walter, especially the more that we get to know Walter, the more we kind of realize, wait, why did you bring your like 11-year-old asthmatic brother?
Well, notice that later on, this guy, when he brings him back, he only brings him back when Walter's gone.
Right. Even still, I think.
I guess what I'm saying is maybe he recognizes, oh, that's not a great idea anymore. And so then he adjusts. And he didn't realize it at the beginning, the first time.
That's a possibility. But I'm kind of with Heidi. I think it's a shortcoming. I think it needs to be explained by the end of the book.
Is that because you feel a dissonance? I don't mean to probe here. I'm just trying to. I guess it's just interesting to me how books work on people. You know, like what do people?
Yeah.
We all kind of have our own responses to stuff. It's like,
yeah,
why,
yeah.
Why does a book? Why do you think you respond to a book this way or whatever?
I don't know that it's a dissonance. It's just such a significant decision, and it's a decision that is. I think, as Heidi has said, lacking an adequate motivation or a clear motivation. It's like, maybe this is overstating it, but I'll do it for the sake of the point. If Davey brought Reuben to the edge of a cliff in a windstorm and like made him put his toes over the cliff in the windstorm, and we don't know the reason why Davey did that, we're kind of like, okay, we got to have an explanation for putting Reuben in that level of danger. We've got to have an explanation.
Yeah.
And if we don't get one, I think it's a shortcoming in the book. But I'm totally willing. I think we're all willing to say,
okay,
let's see how it plays out.
Right.
Huh. Well, before we go,
I'm so curious. Sometimes David will do. Huh. And having the only one who's read the book.
I know. Well, you hear the intake of breath and you're like, this could be a comment. Or.
Well, if I reveal my motivations, then I'm not.
We don't mean to probe.
There needs to be a little bit of, you know, I need to be somewhat mysterious. Otherwise, like, you know, I become too one-dimensional as a character. Speaking of non-one-dimensional characters, I do want to talk about Roxana and the budding romance at the in the middle of this section. And I want some. I wanted to hear from both of you what you think about this. And I don't want to just say what do you think about this. So I do want to look at a specific scene, and I want to talk about it. It is the one that ends on 242. So let's start on 240 and let's end the show with this, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Heidi, are you up for doing a little bit of reading?
Absolutely.
Okay. At the bottom of 240, there's a new section that starts. And just for some context, he has been not feeling well and the father's been gone and Roxana has taken care of him and she gives him the cocoa. Well, offers him cocoa and he says no. And she says, we'll whip that fever. She uses the words better, darling, ask the question. And then that means a great deal to him. And then that's where we begin here. So 240, where it says sleep that day. Can you read read two paragraphs and then Tim, you want to pick it up with I'll admit?
Yeah.
241. Cool. All right. Take it away.
Sleep that day was a warm pool into which I dove and stayed, sporadically lifting my head to sense the world. Roxana entered with a bowl of beef broth and later with buttered saltines. Swede stood by the bed a few times, waiting for me to open my eyes, which I didn't. Once I surfaced to the rattle of papers and found her on a chair next to the bed, pretending to rub out some words on a page. Her regret at my awakening was also counterfeit. She happened to be waist deep in a new Sundown episode. Barely
you guys, I just want to stop you there like I would do with my students because I am. This paragraph excites me so much.
The one that's coming?
No, the one that we just read. The one that she just read. It's like the way he sticks to his metaphor.
Yeah,
is so nice. it's a warm pool into which he dove and stayed, and then the writer just stays in that pool too because we get how it says
surface.
She surfaced to the rattle of papers.
Waist deep.
Yeah, waist deep. All the different ways that he sticks to that are so nice, but they're not overbearing. So he sticks to his metaphor without crushing us on the head with it, which I think takes some skill. Anyway, carry on.
I like this next sentence a lot, by the way. Barely conscious, I listened some drunken editor.
All editors are drunk. Let's just be clear. Metaphorically.
That's so great. You'll recall how Sonny started as ramrod lawman, then found himself compelled to questionable action, and had lately grown into the best of misunderstood outlaws. This new chapter placed him in an undiscovered valley high in the mountains, a snakeless Eden and matchless hideout. Its meadows were the rippled green of the resting sea, fed by springs and by a vigorous brook twisting down to a pool with a floor of polished stones. Moreover, this valley had but one entrance, a steep slot through canyon walls, which one tucked stick. Wow. Let me say that again. A steep slot through canyon walls, which one tucked stick of dynamite could obliterate forever. Yes, Sonny owned a stick. In fact, he had tucked it already, back in a crevice away from rain. Should trouble threaten, he could merely strike a match and seal himself in paradise forever.
I'll admit that even in my groggy state, this seemed a lot like Lassiter's condition in Riders of the Purple Sage. Swede didn't mind the observation. She said other writers had told this story also, and that not even Zane Grey was the first. She said it was such a true story, it needed recurrent tellings so as not to fall out of circulation completely. She asked whether it would be wrong for someone to write a story already about pirate gold buried under an X since Mr. Stevenson had already done it. Of course not. Well, secret valleys with sealable entrances were just the same, Sweet said. Places and things were so real in the world, they were often disbelieved. Sonny, anyhow, was holed up in this pretty gorge with the dynamite placed. He hadn't set it off because, first, he had wanted his wife up there with him. I was a little bewildered about the wife business since Sonny's undefined connections to various past ladies, but boy, I was tired. I didn't bring it up. In fact, at roughly this point, I drifted off again. When finally I woke of my own doing, the blanket over the west-facing window was shot with orange pinpricks. The day was over. The fever whipped, and no one had come to steal my breath. I washed up and went downstairs, sticking out my chest like Horatius. Keep going, David.
Yeah, but we could spend a lot of time thinking about why he mentions Horatius here. And also, I like that at the end of the section, once he's feeling better, he washes up, which calls back to the idea of the warm pool at the beginning of the section. And then the idea of the sea and the springs and the brook, which is used in the metaphor from her story. All of this is so tight.
Yes.
Read another paragraph.
How quickly I'd come to expect Roxanne to make a big deal of me, and how kind she was not to disappoint. At my appearance, she smiled, pressed her palm against my forehead, a sensation I enjoyed, remarked on my sturdy constitution to recover so fast, and introduced me to a bowl of vegetable soup. Sweet ate too, while Roxanna worked in the kitchen beside us, thumping up crust for a pie. Things were close to perfect.
I'll pick it up there. When's Dad coming home? I asked. This evening, Roxanna said, checking the clock. He called earlier. He's sure anxious to see you both. How'd it go with Mr. Anderson? He didn't say much. I guess there's no big news. She rolled out that crust in about 6 strokes and laid it across a metal pan. So they didn't find Davy? Not as of this morning. Where do you suppose he is? It was a little mean, my persisting this way. I only asked because I knew the answer and felt smug knowing it. Maybe it was my small-hearted revenge against Dad, my way of suggesting he hadn't been led to go off with Putrid after all. Then Roxanna turned to me with an encouraging smile, and I saw that she was scared for Davy. Scared for him, though she'd never met him. And instead of smug, I only felt underhanded. We have to be steadfast, she said now. We have to have faith, you two. That's all. You see, she'd begun to use Dad's language. You notice something like that. And watching her, I noticed too she was wearing earrings, little gold hoops. And then, while in no way impatient, she seemed eager to get the pie in the oven and her hands washed and the countertop clean where she'd rolled out the crust. Sweet had been eating in an unusual quiet. Out of nowhere, she said, if Dad says we have to go home, I'm not going to let him. Neither am I, Roxanna replied. I looked at her quick, but she was scrubbing the counter, all business and not about to meet my eye. So then this section leads into the section where he comes back and we get all this stuff about their relationship and how he goes outside and how she starts wearing perfume, which by the way is also a liquid, and how when the next section, when he gets back, his father's expression is curiously buoyant and alien, which is a phrase we could also spend a long time talking about. But what I want to know from you is, you were talking about motivations earlier and we were questioning whether there's enough motivation for Davy's choices. Is there enough motivation for this relationship, or is there enough context or seeds planted or whatever phrase you want to use? Is there enough of that to make sense of this relationship between Roxanna and Jeremiah Land? Heidi, I will turn to you first with that.
I think yes. I think...
Great, Tim.
Yeah. That's all. No,
just kidding.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Well, she's lonely. And she's been abandoned, or she has driven off this man who's somehow done her wrong. And
right.
And then this family that needs her and is in danger and has like a really good available man who is kind and gentle to her. And I mean, all of this, I absolutely understand how she has become invested in this family and is starting to fall in love with this man. And her helpful, life-giving presence is bringing them all back to life, including Jeremiah Land. Mm. So yeah, I think everything about it has plenty of motivation.
Tim, do you think it changes her character that earlier on she's this sort of like, you know, I mean, there are even these masculine images used with her. She's this sort of tough character, mm-hmm. Who kicks this other dude out of her house, as Heidi mm-hmm. said. And then here, steadily, everything sort of begins to change and she's got a much more maternal persona. Does that work for you?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. I think like when she puts on the dress, when Mr. Land is coming home, that to me is like this kind of like pivot moment that she's willing to let go of being kind of how would you describe it? She's willing to relinquish a little bit of... What's that?
She's like allowing some warmness to come.
Yeah. She's allowing some warmness. Letting her guard down. Right. And I think that to me is like maybe the moment that we see this different aspect of her character. And also, I just have sort of assumed that there are offstage conversations happening between her and Mr. Lane. And that's kind of where a lot of the romance has been budding, percolating.
And the story's from the perspective of a little kid, who's only going to be privy to so much of it. And so when I imagine that for little children who have a parent who, and I know he's not really little, but he's still a child, who have a parent who then gets into a relationship, the mystery of that is probably pretty confounding.
Yeah.
I think he probably captures that pretty well. One thing I really like is the way. The scenes where he goes up to the Airstream, and every time he comes into the house, he doesn't just sort of wander in like he's a friend. You know, there's a formality about it. He brings a flower, he knocks on the door, he wears a suit. And in some ways it seems like he's recognizing this is a character or a person, I guess, in Roxana who has been through trauma, who has had to endure things, who I have to earn her trust, you know? So every time I go to the door in a romantic sort of way, every time I engage with her in a sort of romantic way, I'm asking her to trust me. And so he takes a formal approach, not just because he's a formal sort of a guy, but because he recognizes that every time he does something like that, he's asking her to let her guard down a little bit. And when she opens the door, every time she does that, she's removing a barrier between them. And to remove a barrier between them is to inherently say, I trust you. I'm going to reveal something more of myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, you know, and as the novel goes on, even by the end of this section, bit by bit by bit, she has removed the hardened exterior, right? She has made herself less sort of tough. And, you know, the door sort of seems to represent that, you know, in a really interesting way. But it's all wrapped up in character too. So he does all these things that are, Leif Enger does all these things that are representing something about character, but they're all wrapped up in what characters would actually do. Like, it doesn't feel wrong that a character like Jeremiah Land, who can walk on the air, would go live in the Airstream and then knock on the door wearing a suit every day. Like, it feels consistent with him, just as it feels consistent that she would let her guard down in this way. It doesn't happen overnight. The book slowly reveals that. And like, again, there's a lot of skill in the characters. As you were talking about how, Heidi, you were talking about how he gets character, like he gets how to reveal character. I think that's a great example of it.
I agree.
Before we go, either of you want to offer a passage that you really liked or a moment or anything else that you want to add? Heidi, I'll let you go first.
I loved the whole conversation about honor.
Oh, darn. That's what I was going to say, Heidi.
Well, we've been going a while. Let's use that as both y'all's passage and then let's talk about it.
What page is it?
Same I couldn't day, find no. it either.
It's on 2-44.
44. I had it marked, but then I had to take out my bookmark to find one of the other passages we read.
Yeah. So it's that night So the passage at the beginning of this section is fascinating. And we can talk about that if you want also. But so then it says that night he goes up to pack his clothes and he goes out there and then Ruben asks Swede, why is he doing that? And that's on 244.
Right. Yep. We're not moving out there. Only Dad. She said, how come he is? It's for honor, she said. It's a declaration you like to hear about your own father, and I was pleased by the confident way she said it. Oh, good. He's still going to come in the house in the daytime, but he's going to sleep out there. There seemed to be something going unsaid here, though I didn't know how to reach whatever it was. I'd already asked the only question, how come, and had my answer. Swede said, he told me he wants to make sure the heater's working in the trailer. Remember that night it got so cold? Uh-huh. But it's really just for honor. She was pretty proud to have figured this out. I was proud of her too. I would have believed the heater story for sure. I love that. It raised a question though. Don't you think we should move out there with him then? Anyway, I'm not going to go past that. But it's hilarious. It's sweet. It speaks again to Ruben's kind of
innocence,
darling, and also frustrating level of dense innocence and Swede's just love of honor and how black and white she is about the world.
Yeah.
And to his character. I mean, it's just, it's funny and sweet and perfect. I loved it.
I was laughing because I was reading about how Leifanger wrote this book for his kids, like kind of to amuse them. And that they're all these, they recommended, like they came up with all kinds of ideas, much like the conversations between Swede and Ruben, where she's asking Ruben for help. But then I was thinking about this section and that line about there's so much that's going unsaid and how he probably was like, yeah, you know, they won't get the, some of the backdrop of what's going on there about why he would go out to, you know, not, he wouldn't stay in the house, but he's just going to leave it unsaid and have a little, you know, wink, wink in there. It's pretty funny. I was just imagining him laughing and trying to do that with, in a way that's not going to get his kids asking questions. Mm. Tim, what did you like about this passage?
I just like it. I like the whole, I like what Jeremiah Land did. You know, like, I don't know. I just like the action that he made that choice.
The decisiveness of it, you mean?
Yeah, and that, like, something changed in his relationship to Roxanne, so he deliberately put this kind of, I don't want to use the word barrier, but I'm just not smart enough to think something else, barrier of honor between them by moving out.
Right.
But it's not a barrier that's like a wall you have to scale. It's a barrier that she makes the choice to open. Like he gives her the choice to let him in. It's not like a Romeo and Juliet barrier where he has to climb to the top of the wall and scale in.
Yeah, window. Right, right.
It's like the barrier is one that is, it's a barrier of decision. Like he's letting her decide, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I love the little passage at the top of that page where it says that then dad's hand let go and just for a moment encircled Roxanna's waist. He was laughing. And when he turned to us, he'd never appeared stronger or more like himself or more capable of stepping up to what might be required. And then we get, and then that's the moment in the book where he decides to go live outside. Mm. Like in terms of the way the narrative is structured, maybe that wasn't the moment when he decided, but after that, he decides to do it. And there's something transforming, like she and their relationship is actually transforming him, at least in the eyes of his son and thus in the eyes of the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Any final thoughts on anything else?
None from me.
We went almost an hour and a half today, so I guess this was a reasonably interesting section.
So much to talk about.
Well, for next week, we are going to be talking about the ending. The final, what, 37, 38 pages or something like that.
And then I'm a little apprehensive, I'll admit it. I don't...
Scared? You're scared?
Well, I have an expectation and I can't tell if I hope I'm right or not. So I'll let you know next week. But, yeah.
You can't tell if you like, you can't understand yourself enough to tell if you want to be right.
Maybe that's what I mean. That felt confusing, but yeah, that's probably it.
I wouldn't say something in a confusing way. So I think it's you.
It's probably me. This is a me problem. So I'm excited. I've really loved this book. So
okay, I want to hear. Tim, what do you hope happens?
Oof. Oh, gosh. This is going to sound strange. I hope that Andreessen is successful in apprehending Davy, that Davy is safe, that, gosh, I do not have benevolent thoughts toward Walter. I hope he goes down. I'll just leave that ambiguous enough. I kind of hope that I hope that Jeremiah Land and Roxanne get married. I hope that Sarah moves into their care and that she and Davy kind of have like a promise that when he gets out of prison, might be a little while, that they have like a future together. Who else? And Swede.
We know, but we know Swede lives and becomes a writer. Like that's kind
of
Yeah,
we've got enough of that.
Yeah.
And I hope, I don't think there's any way that we can finish the book without Ruben surviving his asthma. So
that's he's telling the story, so that's
right.
But he could be telling it posthumously, I suppose.
I suppose so.
Heidi, what do you hope happens?
I hope that the right people die and that Ruben finds his breath.
You hope that the right people die. So what if you don't know who the right people are right now?
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. That's my fear.
That you don't know what's right and wrong. Also, do you mean right and wrong, like in a cosmic sense, or right and wrong for the novel?
I just want Jeremiah Land to tell me what to do and stop being, I'm just kidding.
Hoping for characters in a novel is a complicated thing.
That's exactly right. Yes. Because there are things that you need to do to tell a good story.
Yep. Yep.
And that costs the reader something. And that is as clear as I'm going to be about my expectation of the end of this novel. And so
it's like Well, you know how when people say it's like Harry Potter, right? Mm-hmm. 7 books. You've been reading them forever and ever. Like you're growing up with these books if you're reading them as a kid, or some TV show that's been on for a lot of years and you know, and then they say the ending is coming. And all these people have like their theories of what's going to happen or the things they want to have happen. And then at the end of the story, so many times people aren't happy with it because it wasn't what they wanted for the character. Then right. The question is, but does that mean that it wasn't right for the book itself, like within the context of the story, and distancing ourselves from that between our own hopes and what's right for this, like hoping for what we want.
Right. Like looking
at a very complex thing.
Yes. Looking at the competing forces of this novel, there are some things I expect will have to happen in order to tell a good story. And it makes me feel a little sad. So,
right. Yeah.
That's my, but it also, the part of telling a good story is the ending that is, and we've said this before a million times, the ending that is unexpected, but it's just what had to happen. Right.
Yeah.
So, and you're like, oh, of course. Right. So, so predicting in the end of a novel is tricky business because so anyway, I am emotionally invested in this novel. And so I hope the right people die and I hope Ruben gets his breath. Those are my two things.
Well, speaking of endings that are surprising, don't forget that next week we are posting the first episode of our conversation on Crime and Punishment, which is a book we're going to be spending the next several weeks with. So, or the next several months with, rather. So if you want access to those conversations, don't forget to head over to patreon.com/closereads to support the show and then get access to those bonus episodes. And then also, don't forget that after next week, we are going to be answering your questions. So we will post the thread on Facebook there soon for that. But if you want to email your questions, you can do that. And of course, the way to do that is closereadspodcast@gmail.com. Heidi and Tim, do you want to add anything else before we mercifully let people go?
No.
All right. Well, with that then, for Tim McIntosh and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next week. And in the meantime, happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.